Deal. A lot of people in our world are very confused about Kabbalah, and sometimes that confusion leads to a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding, and chalila b'chas, even worse, rejection and inane statements about Kabbalah. Okay, so let me first give you a little bit of a background, okay, just to put things into perspective. Okay, 99% of our Masara in the Middle Ages, of the people we study, maybe not 99, but 90% of the people, while they were also learning halacha and gemara, philosophy, many of them, some did, some didn't, were also studying Kabbalah. The Rashba studied Kabbalah. The Ramban studied Kabbalah. The Ravid studied Kabbalah. The Yosef Cairo studied Kabbalah. The Rizal studied Kabbalah. If you were a Rishon, you didn't study Kabbalah, you're a little odd, right? The one exception is, of course, the Rambam, who reinterprets some of the phrases in the Gemara, which refer to Kabbalah. Now, like with everything else in our Masara, you can find a Shita that held differently a minority opinion. I think Moshe Feinstein once said, if you went through the history, you could put together a sefer of all the bizarre Shitas that all the Gedolim put together and come up with a book of Kfir. He held this and he held that. Okay, so the Rambam had a super rationalist view of Judaism, of Yiddishkeit. But Kabbalah exists. What role does it play? Why don't we practice it, most of us? What did Hasidim do to Kabbalah? Let's clear the table, okay? Okay. I'm going to say something now that's going to just shock you. Kabbalah is not mysticism. Kabbalah is a rational study of knowledge. What does that mean? Let's get started, okay? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is unknowable. There are no words in the human vernacular to understand Hashem. Any word that you can conjure just doesn't apply. He's not tall. He's not short. He's not tasty, he's not untasty. He's not hot, he's not cold. I challenge you to come up with any word, and by definition, since any word your mind can come up with is taken from human experience, it simply won't apply to Hashem. By definition. That's why philosophy, by its definition, is flawed. Because philosophy is an attempt to use your mind and human mental conventions to try to understand Hashem. Just because it's flawed doesn't mean it's meaningless. Some people find it very meaningful, so they find it less meaningful. So it's flawed, but for some people it's still very enriching. But the whole process, let me see how I can define Hashem, I can define HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even if you're the wisest person on the earth, and you collected all the data possible, it's not a question of your study, your rigor, you just don't have the word, you don't have the terms. It's like trying to describe a scientific phenomenon without the terms to even begin to describe it. So you can't describe Hashem. Now, Hashem is indescribable, He's infinite, and yet He created this world. So here we are in this world, that person making a lot of noise with a little wagon or something, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is infinite, far, far, far above. And some, how does HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinite, non-physical, non-describable presence become that wagon? How does Hashem create that wagon? Not just that wagon, but the life that continues to drive this world, the force, life, energy. How? So Naan Makobel says, I don't have the tools. I don't have the words. I don't have the tools. I'm stuck in this world of phenomena. I'm born into this world. I can do what? Science helps me understand what and how, but not why. What's the spiritual substrate? I can deconstruct a molecule of water into hydrogen and oxygen and know how they're bonded. But why are they bonded that way? Why does hydrogen and oxygen bond that way, 2-to-1, and not 1-to-2? Or why does hydrogen and oxygen bond that way to make water as opposed to hydrogen and sulfate? Science isn't equipped to do that. So I can't explain how HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates that hydrogen and oxygen. I can't explain why Hashem put it that way. I can't. So I leave that distance intact. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is indescribable, unknowable, infinite. I'll never know. I just stick to the world down here, the world we call Nigla, which is halacha, Torah, and of course, in non-Torah world, science and Rashi. Okay? That surrender is called Yirat Shamayim. Yirat Shamayim means not fear, you're not afraid, you're not shaking, you're not trembling. Yirat Shamayim is you know, you don't know. You know, you can never know. And of course, the second part of Yirat Shamayim is not just the knowledge that you know you can't know, but the submission to that higher wisdom that you can never know. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me, put on tefillin, and may not fully understand tefillin, but I know that I can't ever know more than Him. And therefore, I submit to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon. There's no way I can even begin to understand. And even mitzvah sichlios, even rational mitzvahs, I know there are levels and levels and layers that I know I'll never know. So a rationalist, an empiricist, someone that sticks to the rules of Nigla, says that whole distance that I can't explain, I'll just leave as a distance, and I'll stick to my own realm, and I'll explore the how and the what's and the why of experience, not the why of Hashem in creation. The why of experience is, well, why does Hashem want me to remember Mitzrayim, and why relationships important, and why Chesed? So I'll explain the why, but not the why of Hashem, and not the why of creation, not the why of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is expressed in this world. I'll ask whys, but the whys will still be limited to the realm that I inhabit. I'm going to concern myself primarily with this realm, even though I know that this realm is not everything, because it can't be. It doesn't address why had this realm come to being, how is it supported. Now, the problem with that is that there's a great distance. Yirat Shamayim is built on distance. Some people say, well, I can't really feel close to Hashem. And feeling close to Hashem is called Avas Hashem. We feel, do you understand Hashem? You live with Hashem. It's a palpable part of your life. I can't really excel in Avas Hashem given that great distance. So I've excelled in Yirat Shamayim. How will I find Avas Hashem? Which is why when the Rambam describes Avas Hashem, it's very, very empirical. You appreciate what religion does to your life. So you love HaKadosh Baruch Hu because of how religion impacts your life. You're not really loving Hashem. You're loving the impact of the gift that He gave you, and therefore you're loving what you know He gave you a gift. You're not loving Him. You're loving something He did to you, which is where the Rambam maxes out on Avas Hashem in Hilchos Teshuvah Perek Yud. Kabbalah says, let's try to map. Let's try to map the worlds that separate between infinity, non-physicality, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the infinite essence, and that water flask that you just are drinking from, this cup of water that I'm drinking that Hashem created, or life that Hashem supports, or let's try to map that. Now, here's where people make a mistake. That is not empirical, but it is rational. What I mean it's not empirical is we don't have the tools to prove it. Empiricism means I can go out, conduct a study, and come up with statistics. I can go out and take a blade of grass and put it under the microscope. And go inside and dissect the bird and see its organs. And they have the tools to uncover knowledge. That's called empirical. Kabbalah is not empirical, but definition, because you are locked into this world. So you can't possibly have the tools to understand the worlds that intervene between you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You can't prove that they are not there. You simply, it's like being in a room. Remember the Truman Show where you, the whole world is just a stage. So imagine reaching the outer limits of this universe in a spaceship powered by fusion energy, and you reach the outer limit, and there's a little door handle, and you turn the door, and then you walk into another world. That's why it's called Kabbalah, because you have to accept the truth. You can't prove the truth. It's Davar Shem Mekablim. You accept it from people rather than proving it. That's why it's called Kabbalah. However, it's not mystical, and it's not irrational. Namely, if you went back and visited the Ramban studying Kabbalah in his room, you know what he'd be doing? It'd be a pen and a paper. He'd be writing and thinking. He would be rationally analyzing a system of truths and interactions that he couldn't prove. But the process of analyzing them would be rational. So based on this world and based on that world, this is how the two worlds interact. Prove it? I can't prove it. As opposed to a scientist who'd be rationally analyzing some chemical process. I'll prove it to you. I'll show you based on the following data. So the process and methodology is rational. It's not mystical. Because you're analyzing with a pen and paper in your mind. It's a very, very, very intellectual pursuit. You're just rationalizing things you can't possibly prove. And that's what makes it non-empirical, but rational. Now, there are strands in Kabbalah of people throughout the centuries that it's not enough for me to analyze these worlds. I also want to try to bridge these worlds and reach up for worlds. That's where it becomes mystical. Where I need to find experiences that will take me to these worlds and have the impact of these worlds in ways that I can't explain. And that's mystical activity, contemplation, levitation, material and whatever you feel, whatever mystics felt could take them into another world. Ramban never tried to go to the other world. Ramban stayed in his world, but analyzed worlds that were between him and HaKadosh Baruch Hu because of it. Through the truths that he had acquired. So that's what a lot of people misunderstand. They clump together mysticism and Kabbalah. They turn Kabbalah into something non-rational. It's all hocus pocus. It's truths that we have through our Masara. And I'll tell you where the Masara comes from in another moment. It's truths that come to us through our Masara that we can't prove. That's why it's called Kabbalah. And those truths help us map the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence is converted from something non-physical and infinite into our finite and palpable world. Those worlds are called Abia. Anyone know what Abia stands for? You probably do, Ariel. Atzila, Bria, Yitzira, Asiya. In each world, Hashem's presence becomes ever slightly more physical. So in the upper world of Atzilut, Hashem's presence is, that's what I'm looking for, the secretions or the separations of infinity that start to become more physical. Like, for example, say something gross, but imagine you blow your nose and some mucus comes out that it hardens. So, at one point, it was one substance became another substance. The Kodesh Baruch Hu's essence is eternal, infinite. I have to say, Kabbalah. It's eternal and infinite, and then it starts to separate from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and take a different form, become more physical, slowly, slightly, gradually in each world. And within each world, there's a lattice system by which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinite, non-physical essence trickles down through that process of becoming a little more physical. What do we call that lattice?
Spheros.
These are the spheros in each world. And each sphera takes a part of Hashem and expresses it differently on its path to becoming the traits, experiences, materials that we know in this world. So Kabbalah is like studying a map. It's cartography. Let's study the map. Let's see what happens in the world of Atzilus. Let's see what happens in the world of Briah. Let's see what happens in the world of Yitzir. Let's see what happens in the world of Asiya. And we occupy a small little part of the world of Asiya. So we think we're in a really big place. We're in a really, really, really small place, but it feels so large. You can spend your entire life. We'll talk about this a little bit later, what Kabbalah does for me. As someone who doesn't study Kabbalah, doesn't practice Kabbalah, but an awareness of Kabbalah, what does Kabbalah do for me? Okay, that's number one. Where is my sheet? Oh, you took my sheet. He's got the first sheet. I'm trying to make sure that I have it. You have my sheet, Sean? Yeah, this is my notes.
Everyone has
respect. We thought it was Kabbalistic. Okay. Where does Kabbalah come from? Okay, so let's start backwards. Okay, the Sefer HaZohar makes its first appearance in the 13th century. So if you ask academicians, it's a 13th century work. And people who want to devalue Kabbalah, yeah, it's just something that someone in the 13th century wrote. But our Masara tells us that this is something that existed way, way, way before the 13th century. The book was either hidden or the book was either compiled, rather, just like Torah Shabbat Pabim and Torah Shabbat Sad. But we already have Chazal telling us that Avraham Avinu received a Sefer HaYetzirah, Sefer HaKabbalah, which he received from Adam HaRishon. So we already have documentation in Chazal of the Sefer. And of course, in the Gemara, the study of Kabbalah is called what? Maisa Bereishis. And? Maisa Merkabah. So Maisa Bereishis is how HaKadosh Baruch Hu translated his essence into the creation of the world. Maisa Merkabah is how Hashem presents in this world. And of course, the Rambam, who didn't buy into Kabbalah, he interprets Maisa Bereishis and Maisa Merkabah as physics and metaphysics. So Maisa Bereishis is laws of physics, velocity, mass, whatever, combustion. Maisa Merkava is metaphysics, thinking about the laws of physics rather than thinking about other worlds. We have our Chazal learning Sefer HaYetzirah. How can you replicate the process? HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating. Rava created a golem, Rava created a calf, and we ate the calf Erev Shabbos. So this Masorah that we have, the first Sefer of Kabbalah actually is in the 12th century of Spain. But it's not as popular a Sefer. I don't remember the name of the Sefer. But in 1300 is when the Sefer of HaZohar, which our Masara attributes to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And the Sefer of Shimon Bar Yochai doesn't just map the distance or the intervening worlds between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but because you're mapping it, we know how that world affects us and how we affect that world, and then you feel closer to Hashem, and therefore it becomes a Sefer of Avas Hashem, and Avas Hashem for Am Yisrael. So it's laced with a love. It's not just a dispassionate Sefer, like you write a map. Here's East 13th Street, here's 10th Street, here's 20th Street, but this is the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence trickles down, and it favors the people that he loves, the people he chose, and he loves us, and he expresses his love through that lattice, and we can, of course, affect that in response. Okay? What am I missing? Okay. Throughout history, there are revivals of the study of Kabbalah. They become less popular and then more popular. Obviously, in the Ari HaKadosh's period in the 16th century in Svat. For whatever reason, it's right after the Spanish Inquisition. We'll talk about this a little bit later, what cosmology means and why Kabbalah helps me understand cosmology. But for whatever reason, when you feel the world's in crisis and Gula is right around the corner, because very often those two go hand in hand, you're more apt to think broadly what's happening in the universe, not what's happening in the state of Israel or Detroit. You're thinking about a larger sphere, what's happening in the universe I inhabit. And with every revival, there's also change. And the Ari HaKadosh makes changes to this Kabbalah Sari. So he interprets it a little differently. He receives truths that are a little different because, again, if you're a Mekubal, you have access to truths that are beyond it. And that's, yeah.
How does Ramban's Kabbalah, the Ramban writes about, how does that differ in Ari's Kabbalah?
I'm not enough of an expert to tell you. Not enough of an expert to tell you how that reads. I think the Ari's Kabbalah is more empowering of humanity's ability to redeem the broken cosmos. And it also details more explicitly how the world became broken when the world was created. So there's a whole extra layer to that Ari's Kabbalah beyond just, okay, Hashem created the world, these are the map, this is the way Hashem's essence trickles down. There's a tragedy of Shvira Sakelim, which I'll talk about a little bit later, that occasioned the creation of the world, and we're now activated and weaponized and awakened to try to reconstitute that world in its original perfection. That drama, I believe, from the little I've read, is not dominant in classic Kabbalah. Classic Kabbalah is mapping. The Ari's Kabbalah is redemptive. How can we redeem and repair? That's a short, you know, generalized summary. Okay, and then 200 years after the Ari, 150 years after the Ari, a major, major, major shift in Kabbalah happens, and we call that Hasidus. Where Hasidus is a very, very ambitious project. Hasidus says, look, we have to find a way to offer meaningful religious experience to people who are illiterate. That's basically what Hasidus is. Most of the people who can't study in yeshiva, we don't really understand how to learn Torah. Torah is meaningless to them. Study is meaningless to them. How can we carve out meaningful experience? So the last thing you'd think is Kabbalah, because Kabbalah was always esoteric. It was always for the top 1 percentile. The average person couldn't study Kabbalah. The average person barely could study Gemara. They all said, oh, so what Hasidus tries to do is, let's try to popularize Kabbalah. I don't mean popularize like Madonna and like Hollywood stars who get tattoos on their hands. Let's try to find ways for people to practice the basics of Kabbalah without being forced necessarily to understand all the intricate details of Kabbalah. So for example, just to take an example of something I'll talk about a little bit later. In Kabbalah, as I mentioned before, you want to take a Kodesh Baruch Hu's infinite but integrated presence, because Hashem is integrated, Hashem is non-divisible, which has been spread out across this world, and you want to take actions that will reconfigure Hashem's indivisibility, indeconstructibility, as it once was. So Mekubal thinks, okay, let's see. What does it mean, Hashem's essence? How does it become scattered? What activities do I need to take? How can I integrate? L'shem yichud kutche brichu shchinte. I'm going to try to take the essence of Hashem and reconfigure it into one. For Hasidim, so Hasidim we're told, or one strand of Hasidim says, when you daven, you know what you should be thinking? Because they couldn't even understand the words, how, let alone understand the deeper Kabbalistic meanings. You see this word Baruch in your Siddur? You see how Baruch is, no, not on my paper. See how Baruch has a Beis, and a Resh, and a Vav, and a Chaf Sofis? You see how those letters are separate, but they combine to make a word? So when you read the word Baruch, you should think, just like I'm saying a word, Hashem's separate essences that have become scattered should be combined into one. So you know, it's a very, very non-demanding form of Kabbalah. That you are, if you do this, then it will have this impact in Shemayim. And if just because I don't want to talk too much about Hasidus, but you don't have to use your mind or your study to access understanding of these upper worlds. You have a natural bridge to those upper worlds. What does Hasidus call the bridge to those upper worlds? What? No. Lubavitch is an extremely intellectual Hasidus. Extremely. Doesn't popularize it at all. The Muslim Hasidus says, instead of you being forced to go through the process of understanding the worlds and entering the worlds and repairing the worlds, you have a conduit to those worlds. Who's your conduit to the world? The Rebbe. So that's why the Rebbe becomes, you hold on to the Rebbe by eating his food, by supporting him financially, by, and that's why the Rebbe is in meritocracy. Oh, the smartest person becomes the Rosh Hashiva, the best Magid Shiva. It's not meritocracy. It's genealogical. If you have the genes, you're the conduit. If you don't have the genes, you're the biggest gadol around. You're just not the cosmological conduit to the other world. So Chassidus is a form of modern Kabbalah. But it's not Kabbalah, and Kabbalah existed independent of Chassidus. And if Ramban heard that Chassidus were associated with Kabbalah, he'd have a heart attack. Like, what are you talking about? It's a form of Kabbalah, and it takes Kabbalah. But Kabbalah were people sitting there studying, not eating Rebbe's fruit. I'm not disdaining it. I'm just saying it wasn't what you associate with Kabbalah. It was people rationally analyzing maps of worlds between Hashem and our world that we can't access through empirical study. Yes,
I have a question. You mentioned like something about multiple aspects of Hashem's essence. Does that like detract a little bit from like, you know, Hashem HaKad?
Of course, but look at this world. If it all comes from Hashem, this is a world of dichotomy and diversity. Has every single blade of grass come from Hashem? Has good and evil come from Hashem? If you say an Od Mavadon, you live in a world of diversity and dichotomy. That's the split. Okay, now. One or two comments about Rosh Hashanah Bar Yochai, and then we'll talk a little bit about how myself, someone that doesn't practice or actively study Kabbalah, what Kabbalah does for me, why I appreciate it. Okay? Okay. Rosh Hashanah Bar Yochai is the author of the Zohar, although academicians will not prove it because the Sefer just comes out in the 13th century, but our Masorah tells us that he's the one that compiled the traditions that already existed from Avraham Avinu and were already delivered to Moshe at Har Sinai. It's not like he just came up with ideas. He was the one that compiled them, but the text didn't appear until the 13th century. And when he died, his last sentence was, since he was involved in the whole of the Kabbalah, Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, someone, whenever you see Rabbi Shimon, we're reading Rabbi Shimon Shitas, it's not like some, you know, Mekubal out in Svad, who we have nothing to do with except for once a year. This is someone we study literally every single day of our lives. On his day that he passed, he said, when you come and gather on my day that I ascend to Shemayim, we'll give you a bracha. So because of that, people go to Rosh Hashanah Bar Yochai's kever on Lag BaOmer. And the minute probably dates back to the 16th century. In the 20th century, it blows up and becomes this modern pilgrimage with thousands of people. There are pictures. Go online tonight. You can see pictures. There are 200 people around the kever of Rosh Hashanah Bar Yochai. Ironically, not just on Lag BaOmer, it became a month-long ceremony. Interestingly enough, participated in by Jew and Gentiles. The Arabs participated in it as well. So look at the old pictures of Shem Bar Yochai Simula, Lag BaOmer. It was a regional experience that people gathered around his kever. Of course, today we have transportation and mass media and mass awareness. And unfortunately, what happened last year was infrastructure not keeping up with interest. Okay, I just want to make sure I'm not skipping any steps here. Okay. What is Kabbalah? I'm missing one page here. You don't have that fifth page. Okay. Okay, fourth page. Anyway, that doesn't make sense. What does Kabbalah do for me? Okay. I'm going to look at my notes because I don't want to miss anything. I didn't really get a chance to think that much. I was on the run today. One second. Okay. Before I describe what Kabbalah does for me, let me pose the following question. Well, if Kabbalah is real, and I don't think you have a choice to say it's not real, so you can't deny Kabbalah. I mean, I could say you're kofar, but you're denying one of the foundations of our Masorah. So if Kabbalah is real, so why don't we all start learning Kabbalah, operating in Kabbalah? Why don't I study Kabbalah? Why don't I operate in Kabbalah? Who does study Kabbalah? Who does operate in Kabbalah? Before I tell you, I don't study Kabbalah, what does it add to me? Why don't I study Kabbalah? The answer is as follows. Because the world of Nigla is so broad. When I say Nigla, I mean Torah and human experience of Avodas Hashem. And then, of course, whatever Chachma you feel you want to study alongside of that, that you can live a million lifetimes and never begin to exhaust it, right? You're starting to see that in Gemara, right? How many lifetimes can you begin to estimate? It would take you just to learn Gemara B'iyun. let alone Midrashim and Shulchan Aruch and math and whatever else is, and then you start with Kiddush HaChodesh. Spend an entire lifetime just doing Kiddush HaChodesh and just doing Kriyas HaMoedim. So some people say, look, I don't want to leap into another realm and disperse my energies when I have a million lifetimes of accomplishment awaiting me in this world. So I'm going to remain in this world. And that world exists, but I don't have to study it. So is Kabbalah affecting my life right now? Yeah, it is, because I'm being affected by upper worlds and the stream of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in this world. I'm just not studying it. I'm not practicing it. And I'm practicing the world of Nigla. And I have the right, and 99% of the people have the right to remain within that world of Nigla. Now, two comments. Even those who do remain within the world of Nigla, like myself, if let's say you find that there's a moment in which the world of Nigla doesn't provide answers, then you may say, you know what? I want to know how that apparatus works to try to find a solution that the world of Nigla doesn't offer. So, for example, if someone's sick, so they'll go to a hospital, and the hospital doctors will perform surgery, and they'll give them treatment, and we'll daven, which is a form of Nigla, Tekadosh Baruch Hu. And if all those solutions don't seem to be working, then you can go to Makorpal and say, well, science can dissect and can analyze the bacterial infection and the cancerous growth and possibly, but somehow scientific answers aren't solving this. Where does this really come from? How are these upper worlds affecting this cancerous growth? Or this, because at this lower world just dealing with the symptoms or dealing with the root and is not being successful. So Makorpal will say, oh, this is where it's coming from. And therefore, we can nip it in the bud or cut it off at the pass. And I've recommended Mekubalim to people. I've actually, people in my family have gone to Mekubalim. Now, that doesn't mean that the Mekubal is a bigger tzaddik or a bigger miracle doer than the person who is a Talmud Chacham. It just means he has access to information and to ways to employ that information that people who remain in the world of Nigla don't. And normally, it's fine to stay in the world of Nigla because you're fine with that. But in certain cases, like for example, okay, I'll give you an example. Where at one point in your life, at a very interesting point in your life, you're going to come into the world of Kabbalah when you die. I may have Esther when you die and you're buried. We don't have the tools to know what happens on the other side. So that's why all the Chevra Kadishas have practices in Minhagim that are based on Kabbalah. And you ask them, why are you walking around holding each other's girdle, whispering and chanting, telling these words and throwing metal pieces? I'm not going to explain it to you. It's not like the metal pieces are going to ward off the rats from the body. Not a scientific issue. The mental pieces that you're throwing is based on Kabbalah. So that's an example where, even in a normal life, in this case, in the end of life, you're coming into a situation where the Kabbalah is going to affect your life. Let's say Chas V'Shalom, a person gets sick, you go to Mekubal. Let's say, so even someone who's not a person who studies Kabbalah will still have recourse to Kabbalah if they want. If they choose not to, they don't have to. They can say, I want to remain within the world of Nigla. So I choose, for example, under normal circumstances, I choose not to participate in the world of Kabbalah. So, for example, I won't say on Tzvir Tzomer, L'shem Yichud Kodesh Baruch Hu. Because as we'll see in a moment, L'shem Yichud Kodesh Baruch Hu is a Kabbalistic. Now, why won't I say it? I feel cheap not being in that world and just rifling off words. I feel it's disrespectful to Kabbalah. It's not like I deny Kabbalah. I feel like it's just as artificial. I want to be honest with it. I want to have integrity. So I don't practice Kabbalah. I don't study Kabbalah. All of a sudden, once a year, I'm going to say Ho Shebitiferes or Melech Shebigvura in ways that have deep, deep Kabbalistic meaning. But I don't really know all that meaning, and I just feel humble, but inadequate to say those words. I don't say those words out of respect to Kabbalah. No, no. Now, you could equally say, okay, Rabbi Tiger, don't be so crazy. You say the words, you know what it means, you just know you're participating. But fine, both are legitimate. Like when I hear people quoting Sfas Emesis, I go crazy because every word, not every word, but a lot of the words in the Sfas Emes have Kabbalistic references, many of which I know because I've studied a little Kabbalah, and most people, according to Sfas Emes, have no clue what they're saying. And the problem is, it's a very well-written Sefer. So people feel like they're reading something from the VBM. It's not the VBM. Every word is coded, every word, so I have a hard time when people quote Sfas Emes because, oh yeah, the Sfas Emes says we should all love each other and be kind to one another. There are a few Sfas Emeses that way, but when you see words like Chios and Pinimios and Neshama and Zman, and when you see Aner, every word has Kabbalistic reference points. Now, some people will say, okay, Rabbi Tarek, I understand what you're saying. You want to invest all of your limited resources. It's the same Bikiyosian question, right? What should we learn Bikiyosian? What's the answer? Everything. And the sad part is, okay, we have limited resources. You know, limited resources, what do we spend our time doing? So in theory, if I had a million lives and I had a million hours every day and I had unlimited resources per day, I'd love to study Kabbalah, but I don't have. So instead of dispersing and diluting my resources. I want to understand the sugya I'm learning today as best I can. Problem is, I have a wedding today, so I'm barely going to have time to read this. So all of a sudden, I'm going to take my few precious minutes that I can think about the sugya before I give shiur and think about something else. I'd rather not. Some people, the way they're wired, at a certain point, not before you, because it is a stepping stone. You have to step on the foundation of Rashin and Nigla to get to the world of Nistar. This person says, you know what? I don't need to be a Brisker. I don't need to be a Brisker. I studied enough Torah. I know Tanakh. I know Gemara. Now I want to start studying and learning Kabbalah. That's why the Mekubal doesn't have to be a bigger Talmud Chacham than Rav Shechter or than Rav Asher Weiss. I think probably it's a little more involved in the world of Kabbalah. So I just want to try to help you understand why some people do study, why most people don't study, why when a person goes and say, oh, you're copping out, you're not a Mekubal, now that you need... No, I'm trying to make these expressions as clear as possible, not to be crass. Let's say, you know, your sink faucet is stuffed up and you call plumber A, and plumber A can't help, but plumber B has some chemical that plumber A doesn't have. So you call plumber B and say, please unstuff my sink. So it doesn't mean plumber B is better. Plumber B has tools that plumber A doesn't have. Okay, again, I don't want to turn about the plumbing, but I just, you know, people are sometimes stuck between these two poles. What do you mean? Are they better? Are they greater? So why are we going to call them? They're not. It just means you're accessing tools to solve issues in your life that normally you don't feel you need to, and you want to act consistently. So you go to doctors, and 99% of the time, doctors will solve. But a person in Rahmanis is suffering with cancer, and all the doctors have tried all the treatment, and we're at the end of the line, in addition to the tefillah, okay, maybe if we put a pigeon or a bird on the person's stomach, maybe that will. Why? Not because it's voodoo, not because we're eating the mushrooms and the bird together, but because of the way that Hashem's presence cycles down through nature. This is the way to reorient whatever's happening to that person. Okay? Questions? Before I talk about how it changes my life, because that, you know, Emiki has questions on that. But all right, could you just pour me some water for the faucet, please? The upper waters. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I feel like at the previous years have a tendency to kind of lump mystics and global everything together. Just from lack of knowledge. So this is a question that's probably going to come from lack of knowledge. But the Rambam in Yesodei Torah seems to be talking about like very non-physical things at the very least, like metaphysical stuff. Talking about like the different spheres. That's not within the realm of Kabbalah.
I don't think so. I think he's just describing how. Metaphysics, not cosmology. Cosmology means how upper worlds affect lower worlds. Metaphysics is still this world, but how we understand why physics, how physics in this world, not how it operates, but why it operates.
Right.
As opposed to how this world is impacted by upper worlds, in which physics is an irrelevant issue.
Right, so does that mean that he was trying to base it off of like the scientific stuff at the time, or was also...
Yeah, I don't know enough, but okay. I know enough to say he didn't study Kabbalah, and he felt that Kabbalah didn't most people felt that he didn't exist, okay? But Baruch Hashem, in today's day and age, the study of Kabbalah has been put under the academic microscope. There are real academicians who have studied Kabbalah and can help you articulate what Kabbalah. Gershon Shalom is one example, and if you've heard of some of Gershon Shalom, he's a historian, Moshe Edel, and many people have actually... So there are books out there which articulate, as I'm trying to, but in academic terms, people that have dedicated their lives to understanding, not studying Kabbalah, but articulating what Kabbalah is. And of course, you have to study some Kabbalah in order to do that. Yes?
Also, Mazzolos. Those are metaphysics, are not within the realm of Kabbalah also?
Right, so those are metaphysics, because that's the impact that the solar system, which is our universe, has upon our world. So just because you believe in mazalos doesn't mean you believe in, and of course all of you shouldn't believe in mazalos. Okay, but what affects those mazalos, what makes those mazalos, that's Kabbalah. Okay, so in theory, if we just had enough tools, we could chart the mazalos and chart how it affects human behavior and come up with big data and crunch the data and understand mazalos. So it's empirical. Kabbalah is not empirical. I can't possibly get to those worlds because I just don't have access to those worlds. Okay, how does Kabbalah help me? I listed five ways in which Kabbalah frames my experience. When it frames my experience is awareness of Kabbalah, understanding what Kabbalah is, helps me, even though I'm not in the world of Kabbalah, helps me balance my own possible experience. First of all, obviously something we've stressed a lot in this yeshiva and Baruch Hashem, you're responding well to it, the balance of life between ration and non-ration. and the ability to climb out of that prison of ration, and not everything is what you can understand. Mitzvahs don't have to be only because you understand, and religion is transcendent, and decision life have to be emotional, and just, again, the connection between Kabbalah and emotions has nothing to do with one another. Other than, they're both not rational. They're both not empirical. And in today's world, where we become super empirical, it's becoming easier and easier to get trapped into that world of the mind, and what the mind thinks, and what you score in tests, and what you can understand, and what you can self-mediate, and you start to be skeptical about anything that isn't. And we work really hard in this yeshiva to say, I don't care how smart you are, it's smart, will only get you so far in life, and the biggest decisions, the ones that you need to intuit. And it just helps me realize there's no way I can possibly understand those upper worlds, and therefore there are limits to my ration. Ration is a tool, it's a great tool, it's a sledgehammer. Kadosh Baruch Hu gave it to me, I want to develop my mind. Sadly today there's a bit of a reaction, and people are very, very, say the word intellectual, it's like you're cursing someone out. Chalila v'chas. And you have a responsibility to develop your brain and hone your brain and use your brain, but that's not where identity lies, and that's not where identity begins, and that's not where decisions. It's a tool. It's like having a really strong tool in your toolbox, but it's a tool that you should use. And Kabbalah is always that healthy reminder, because this isn't the world that intellectual or at least empirical thought can possibly pierce. So that's one way that I think Kabbalah helps me, even though I'm not in the world of Kabbalah. Okay. Number two, it helps me broaden beyond this world, as I said before. We think this world is everything. We think this world is all of eternity. This is the entire universe. And then Kabbalah puts this world into a different perspective. Okay, now, that's a very dangerous thing, right? Who else put this world into a different perspective? Darwin did. Darwin shrunk man. As we're not the source of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's masterpiece, we just occupy some branch on an evolutionary tree. We're not going to have our own branch. We share the branch with primates. So, Darwin, and when they started to discover fossils, right? If you look at Copernicus, and when Copernicus basically decentralized our space, we used to think we were the center of the universe. After Copernicus, we're no longer the center of the universe. And then when we started to discover fossils, we thought that we were living in history. Then we realized our 5,000 years is just the blink of an eyelash in terms of the billions of years. So all that can lead to the decentralization of human dignity. So it's dangerous. Kabbalah can decentralize. That's why it's so important to have the Aris Kabbalah, which empowers man. Man isn't just at the low end of the totem pole being affected by all these worlds. But at a certain point, there could be a hubris that sets in the modern world and a satisfaction with this world. And we are the center of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's universe. And this is, and we realize that we're just a small part of something larger. And that's a healthy balance against egotism and against self-centricism and against a world that's becoming more and more narrow and shallow. And seeing everything through not just human experience, but your own personal experience, your own politics, your own perspective, your own people, your own sports team, rather than realizing it's a big, we're becoming very, very sectarian, very polarized, very small and shallow. Identity politics shrinks the human imagination. Because, oh, if you're a Democrat, you have to check these boxes. If you're a Republican, you have to check these boxes. Rather than saying, think about the issues. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you agree that this is true? Do you not agree that this is true? You're not, your identity isn't driven by the political party you belong to. Your identity, by why is sports? Why are people so crazy addicted to sports? Because we don't have anything else providing identity, because we provide a multiculturalism. So you're not a he, you're not a she. It's racist to talk about religion. So who do you bind with? Who do you belong to? I belong to the Yankee Nation. There's no such thing as Yankee Nation. It doesn't exist. That's why sports is becoming so addictive, because it creates a substitute for identity. Your identity should be your hopes, your dreams, your values, your positions, your relationships. Yeah. But once those become cardboard cutouts and you have to take these positions, so then what is your identity? I'm not forging my own identity based on ideas, because my ideas are dictated to me. So I find false stand-ins for identity, sports, politics. And unfortunately, we're descending into that. So on the one hand, you don't want to shrink, man. On the other hand, you want to make sure that there isn't a self-centricism to this world. So that's number two. Number three, and this is in the Kabbalah's theory, and let me take a few steps back, and this is where, ironically, Kabbalah and Zionism start to intersect, and especially Hasidus and Zionism, and a lot of the early religious Zionists were either Hasidim or people who defected from the world of Hasidus. What I mean is as follows, okay? When I talk to you as a non-Mekubal about the fall of this world, so essentially the world fell twice. When did the world fall twice? Once morally, when Adam HaRishon sinned and disobeyed Hashem, and humanity was cast out from Gan Eden into a world of difficulty and labor and work and labor for women, and a world that was cursed. And we had a chance to regain Gan Eden at Har Sinai. Batel Zuhama, the flaws of humanity were now being refined and perfected. But unfortunately, a few weeks later, the Egel Azav, and a few weeks after that, the Meraglim, we fell apart and we fell. And even after repeated attempts to give us a recovery in the Beis HaMikdash, we continued to fall and we surrendered our ability to perfect humanity that was handed to us at Har Sinai. So there are two moral failures, the failure of Adam Rishon and the failure of Am Yisrael, repeatedly starting from the Egel Azav. Kabbalah, especially the Ari's Kabbalah, speaks about a prior fall. And that isn't a moral fall, that is a cosmological fall. And that fall is called Shevira Sakelim, and that fall is inevitable, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu tried to still his essence, which is non-divisible, into this world, but this world couldn't contain his essence in a way that was integrated, and that is called Shevira Sakelim, where the containers that were meant to contain Hashem's essence to create this world, not just this world around us, but this universe, became shattered, and Hashem's essence became scattered, and not just scattered, but covered by parts that make Hashem's. Remember, there's no other, Enod Milvado. It's not like it was covered by evil. It was covered by elements in this world that make it harder for us to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence. What do we call that? Coverings that make it harder for us to see Hashem's essence? Klipos. Klipos are the shells that make it harder for us to see Hashem's essence. Now, if there's this additional, if there's an additional fall in this world, then there's also an additional geula to this world. So when you and I speak about geula, we speak about the two falls. So once Am Yisrael repairs its own moral fiber, then we become tahar, we get back to Yerushalayim, and then we repair humanity, and we go back to Gan Eden. So I speak to you about redemption. Redemption is starts with national, ends up being humanistic or universal. But in Kabbalah, there's a higher level. We're tracing one step back. Once everyone becomes integrated here, then the Kodesh Baruch Hu's essence becomes integrated again. And the way you reach that goal is not just by settling the land of Israel, doing more mitzvahs, but by taking the Kodesh Baruch Hu's scattered essences and putting them back together. What this all means, it's a lot of probably mumble-jumble to you, but I hope some of these terms are things you've heard of, but it means that it activates a human being to be part of the redemptive drama. And I'm not just sitting there and waiting for a Kodesh Baruch Hu to pull the triggers and change the world, but I now have the tools to make changes. And I have the tools to make changes through the mitzvahs that I do when I integrate Hashem's presence, and I have the tools to make changes, therefore, in a nigla way, to resettle the land and initiate geula. So this is, to me, what I find so empowering about, well, ironically, this is the deep irony of Kabbalah, that it's bidirectional. If Kabbalah weren't bidirectional, then it would shrink man. And you'd be at the small little part of a small little world on the bottom of a small little totem pole, and you'd be a fleck of dust. But being that it's bidirectional, man has the power to influence all those worlds and to backwash all those worlds. And of course, in the Nefesh HaChayim, and Chaim V'Lashon, which is the sefer that launches the yeshiva movement, the way you influence all those worlds is Talmud Torah. Because Torah is the highest level, is even higher than all those worlds. And remember, we spoke about this in this year. So by learning Torah, you're activating the worlds not just from the bottom, but from the top, because you're studying Torah, which feeds and neutralizes all those worlds. So to me, that's the third area. Area number one, ration versus irration. Area number two, decentralizing the world I inhabit, realizing I'm part of something larger. Area number three, that it activates me to be part of a redemptive saga, and that's something which I feel very deeply. Area number three is, or four is, I feel my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm able to talk about Hashem's presence in a way that the rational world does not. Right? You could spend weeks and weeks and weeks learning Gemara, never mentioned HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in theory. But when you're learning Kabbalah, you're studying HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're studying HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence trickling down. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the topic. Now, I don't study Kabbalah, but just that awareness that I'm trying to find Hashem and that there are worlds that help me map Hashem is one way, not the only way, of being HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you ask me, Rebbe, I'm leaving Yeshiva Chas V'Shalom at some point, give me a bracha. One of the top five brachas I give you is try to make Hashem part of your life. Try to find a way to make Hashem a palpable part of your life. Or said differently, go back to your high school. How often did anyone say the name Hashem? Very often in our study, we're studying religion and Judaism and morality and history and ethics and values and political activism and Israel and Holocaust.
How often did a Rebbe come in and say, let's talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let's talk about Hashem. Let's talk, okay, I don't know your high schools, but I know that in the past that was an issue. That Hashem was disappearing from the curriculum because we just don't have the, I understand that. Okay, let's study Hashem. What does that even mean? So in Kabbalah, Hashem is the main part of the menu. I'm going to study Kabbalah, but I'm saying, okay, I don't study Kabbalah, but how can I make HaKadosh Baruch Hu the main part of my menu when I study Baba Kama, when I study Sukkah? So that, trying to find Hashem's Ratzon, it makes me realize that Hashem has to be the ultimate destination, the ultimate topic that I'm studying, even when I'm not studying Kabbalah. Okay? The fifth area that Kabbalah helps me is because it's so universal, because it's not about Judaism, it's not about humanity, it's about the universe, it reminds me to always be more universalistic in my outlook, which I think is one of the main identity fissures in Jews today. Right? Think about the Jewish world today. You have a lot of people who are super, super universalists, but when you think about how deeply they live their Jewish identity, not so much. They don't study, they don't daven, but they're out there to change the world and social justice and the Jewish message and how can we be a light unto the nations. And then you have people who are super, super, super Jewish in their identity and they're sitting and studying Torah all day and their mitzvahs. And then their perspectives upon the goyim and sometimes a borderline racist and xenophobic. And what I'm trying to talk to, I just spoke about this in England the other day, is how can you be both and not alongside one another, but to realize if you're chosen, then you have to be a universalist because you're chosen to change the world. So if you're not nationalist, if you're not universalist, then your nationalism is empty. And if you're not nationalistic, then universalism is empty because what message are you delivering? It's really the same. Unfortunately, in our world, it's a broken narrative. The two can't be seen as one, right? The best way for you to be a universalist is to be a West Bank settler. What do you mean? The whole world's opposed to me. It's because the world is broken. But I truly believe that by settling this mountain, I'm advancing Mashiach, and when Mashiach comes, the whole world will enjoy more welfare, more prosperity, less war, less AIDS, less corona, less... So the world doesn't see it that way, so therefore I have to juggle the two and operate within the boundaries of law and international expectation. But ultimately, if they only knew what we were up to, they would be building houses for us in the lunch room, saying, please, settle the land, bring Mashiach, bring Hashem into this world, so that we can solve corona, so that we can solve cancer. Kabbalah, if you're looking for a good word for Kabbalah, okay, don't use the word mysticism. Here's the word to use in this way. The best way to describe Kabbalah is cosmology. Okay? With the presumption that cosmos is larger than the universe. Again, these are just terms, but universe is the world that we, the realm we inhabit. Cosmos is everything. So the study of everything is Kabbalah. People who don't study Kabbalah say, I can't possibly understand everything, I'll stick to the universe. Cosmology is the study of everything. So cosmology, by definition, is a stretching experience beyond Judaism, beyond humanity, and it takes me out of this potential shell that I could get caught in. So number one, ration versus irration. Number two, decentralization. Number three, right, relationship, okay, whatever, relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Number four, activist redemption. Number five, universalization that comes as a product of cosmology. Those are the ways that I feel Kabbalah, I don't study it, but that awareness and that consciousness helps me better navigate the world. Okay? So it's like Ba'omer, again, if I were more of a Mekubal, I'd be buying a ticket and going to Jinn Tayochai, and I'd be interested in doing it anyway. It's even as if it were easier to get there and I had to fight through 10 hours of traffic, you know, anyway. But if I'm really a Mekubal, this would be the day I'd be at Jinn Tayochai's Kever and experiencing it. I don't practice Kabbalah, but I don't sit there sneering and jeering at people. Okay. What a shift from Kabbalah to biblical.
Yeah, 1 minute. So, Targum, yes. We can call Kabbalah if it's not like if it's beyond the universe.